shoot the defence. It's unbelievable, Jeff.
You're comfortable, 100%. You've got your cushion and all that kind of.
Me and have the same height.
Hey,
very good.
I'm in the school zone, so if I get arrested, then I might have to jump off the call.
Yes, yeah, you can do that, Mark. Darius, see, we're live at the moment. This is the joys of live streaming. Mark is driving.
I'm on a cushion.
You're on a cushion, and Rodri's on his best behaviour tonight. So welcome to Shoot Defence on FNX. Brought to you by My Sports and Save Association. I'm your host, Del. This is my co-host, Yannick. He's actually here in the flesh now. He's not in his car doing the Stan Collymore doggy impression. Rodri is here as ever. Welcome back, Rodri.
Cheers, pal. You okay?
Yeah, I'm good, mate. Good, mate. You've done your hair very nicely, so you're very presentable.
Nice and neat tonight.
Nice and neat, yeah.
Yeah, well, everyone's on par tonight, you know, but Jan's the same size as you somehow, but there you go.
So yeah, let me welcome back Mark to the show because it's been a while. Mr. Meredith, how you doing, mate?
Yeah, I'm good, thank you. It's been a busy few months, and I'm afraid I'm not going to come on, but I've missed it. Just very keeping with 6 teams to coach and boys and girls everywhere at the minute.
Yeah, it sounds very strenuous at the moment. How are you coping?
It's been a difficult couple of months, you know. As you know, we got the new addition to the family as well, so he's only 4 months old. So trying to deal with a newborn baby and coach every night and play every weekend has been a big one for the schedule. But we're getting there and it's quieting down now. Thanksgiving's going to come over in the next couple of months, so we'll be able to chill out for 4 or 5 weeks and give them a break until the new season starts again.
Great stuff, great stuff. Well, I'll tell you what, let's go into the football because I think we need the break after the dross that was served out over the weekend. Murdoch's marketing minions at Sky Sports did their level best to sell Liverpool versus Man United some sort of, I don't know, battle of the Titans. But unfortunately, the only thing this so-called blockbuster encounter had in common with the Greek gods is that it was a complete and utter myth. The rivalry that once filtered down from the fans to the players is dead. Gone are the fractious matches that require strong referees. Gone are the days when players needed to be separated. As a matter of fact, gone are the days when fans didn't get on. The Liverpool-United rivalry still exists, but it's more like a who can take a more original selfie with a half-and-half scarf battle. Truth be told, the weekend's game was dour. Many pointed the finger at Mourinho saying he was negative, in inverted commas. Others would argue that he isn't the first Manchester United manager to play a system at Anfield aimed at stifling the home side. Now, De Gea and Mignolet only really had one save to make each. No controversy, no red cards. There was a sweet embrace between De Gea and Moreno, though, so I guess there's a little bit of passion there. This will lead us on to our bite-back question, which is pretty apt. Do you think the Liverpool-Manchester United rivalry has lost its spark? Is it no longer the biggest derby in English football? I'm going to pose this question to you first, little man, because we've had a bit of a heated exchange prior to the show about this game itself. But what do you make of the rivalry? Is it dead? Is it one in church?
I don't think it's dead. I don't think it'll ever be dead between Liverpool and United. But it's lost its spark. It's not the same. I think you can even tell from the terraces now that, you know, even the chanting, the songs, it's not what it used to be. I don't know if it's the decline of the two clubs in recent years, but they're not being as successful as both should be over the last few years, and maybe the decline has had an effect on fans. Mm-hmm. I still feel the bragging and rights are there. You still want to get over Liverpool and vice versa. But like you said, the point, you know, even the game on Saturday, there weren't any flying tackles. I think was it like 2 bookings? It's very rare you see a Liverpool United game with 2 bookings, you know, the whole game. There wasn't a lot of attacking play. It's definitely lost something. Unless both clubs start being successful again and that rivalry starts coming back, I think you might just see more of the same going forward.
Mm-hmm. Mark, what do you reckon? Is it intense? Because I know that you're over at the Liverpool Academy at the moment. What is the general feeling about the derby?
I think that it's lost a lot of its fierceness over the years. And I think that's just looking at it as a follower of the big games. You know, it's been one of those that has really lost its spark. I don't know if it's because the both managers come out now and just try not to lose the game so bad that, you know, their preparation is defend, and it just evens people out on the field. And people have started getting bored watching the same thing every time they play. You know, the international break may have had a bit to do with it this time as well, with the fact that you can't really prep when your players out on international. You know, we've got two teams there who have got a lot of players out at different countries and training in different styles for 2 weeks before the game. So it's always difficult, I'm sure, for the coaching staff to get them back in and get them ready for a big game like that.
And Rod, what do you make of it, mate?
Yeah, it's not. It's not by anywhere near how it used to be. It's a difficult one. It's just because I think Liverpool are not a threat to us, or don't seem to be in and about winning the league. So it's a difficult one. But I don't think it'll ever be as it was. I think it's more City now because, you know, they're fighting for titles, and so are we. We don't think Liverpool have fought for a title since Suarez was there, and even then that they had the Steven Gerrard slip, and then they lost it. To be honest, but no, it's lost its spark, and the game Saturday was just a dead game, wasn't it? It was just exactly the same as last year, unfortunately. But you know, Mourinho, a point there is a good result for us, even though it was a boring game. You know, obviously Mourinho set some traps, and Klopp's not gone for it later in the game, so he's just settled for a point in the end.
Right. Well, a lot of people in the Facebook group page got involved, and I'll just read out two of the comments. Well, Rick, who's a Liverpool fan, says, when the manager of Manchester United accepts a performance like that, it's the beginning of the end. I think it's a bit unfair to blame Mourinho just for that.
I think you need to go back when Ferguson was there. He did the exact same thing. I think the last four times he was there, he got beat. So, you know, it's a good point for us, even though it was a boring game. You'd expect us United to do better. But when Lukaku and Mkhitaryan don't have the best of games, and they're important people to have the better games, because you need Lukaku to hold it up. If he gets a chance, which he did, to put it away, and he didn't. So, you know, it's a difficult one. If Lukaku puts that away and we go away 1-0, it's a masterclass. Lukaku's, you know, he's on form, but, you know, it just didn't go our way, so.
No, I agree. I completely agree with you. And again, I'm going to reiterate what I said to you prior to the show starting, exactly what we just said about Ferguson.
I don't agree.
Well, why don't you agree to it? Cool. Why don't you agree? Why don't you think that Mourinho winning with a proper game plan? Why don't you agree with
the style? A game plan is always good, which I agree. And going away to your bitter rivals to get a point is not a bad result. For me, it was the lack of intent of Man United winning the game. Yes, you set your stall out to defy Liverpool's threat, which you did. But then once you do that, you need to find a game of your own to go and hurt Liverpool. Liverpool are not great defensively. They're not great in midfield. They're not even good they haven't even got a good goalkeeper, in my opinion. They're good up front. If you notify the three guys in Coutinho, there's no threat at Liverpool. They were there for the taking. That's what I meant about the game plan for me. Notify Liverpool's weaknesses, which he did, or their strengths, and then go and attack them where it hurts. United did not have a single attempt in the second half. For me, that's not good enough for the size of Man United. I don't care who they're playing. Game plan or no game plan, United should have a way of trying to attack and try and win the game. That, you know, we keep hearing every time, you know, managers are like, we always try to win the game. United didn't try and win the game on Saturday.
Yeah, but United didn't have to win the game.
It's irrelevant.
They didn't have to
it's
win
irrelevant.
The game.
It's irrelevant. If you've got a game plan with the players that United got attacking-wise, we've spent how much money over the years to try and build an attacking force? We might as well not play Mkhitaryan on Saturday. We might as well put another defender and play six at the back if you're going to play that way, in my opinion. You know,
I think Mourinho had the same game plan or the same idea as Ferguson's going into the game. Do not get beat. And they didn't get beat.
Rodri, I agree with that. Don't get beat to your rivals. I've got no problem with that. But there's got to be a time in a game where you've got to be a bit bold, a bit brave. Go and show
we do, and that's where I go back to where Lukaku didn't have the best of games. People weren't close enough to him when he did get hold of the ball. So it was just enough. The people that we needed in the game to have a good game, they didn't perform, and ultimately it was a non-entity.
Listen, Martial did have a good game. Then Rashford came in, did have a good game. Mkhitaryan was awful. Lingard was pretty much a passenger.
Yeah, but
Ashley Young didn't get a kick, really.
Yeah, but the reason...
So it's not just Mourinho. If Lukaku is doing his job holding the ball up well, which he wasn't doing...
Well, the ball hockey, we're not there for him to hold it.
Come on, don't give me that.
38% of the ball.
38%
of the ball.
Doesn't matter. That's possession. That's possession. All it takes is one lump upfield.
When you've got Mkhitaryan, who's your number 10, 30 yards away from your striker, and the ball goes up to Lukaku,
right,
and there's four defenders surrounding him, where's he going to go?
Right, okay. I'll tell
absolutely
you what. Hold that thought. No, hold that.
I think, just to answer it again, I think you've got to put into play, the internationals. Some people have travelled a long way, played two hard games, and that's going to come into it in the second half. People are going to tire.
Well, that's for both clubs, Andre. My problem with...
I understand that.
In the game, if... hypothetically speaking, Liverpool win 1-0. What would you, as a United fan, say about that game? You would absolutely slaughter United. It's the fact that it finished 0-0 and we can say it's an acceptable result. But if that goes the other way, look at second half the Liverpool. All right, half chances. They didn't have a lot to do. But there was only one team that was going to win that game.
Okay,
that
hang about. Why does Mourinho get all this stick in
this
one?
I'm not blaming Mourinho.
Why does Mourinho? Because listen, I'm gonna get on my high horse on this one because all I'm hearing is that Mourinho's negative, whatever. He's ruining football. Let me tell you something. Just as Custis said the other day, right? What did Jurgen Klopp do? Because the onus was on Liverpool to win. If he knows that United are defending in numbers, why isn't he changing his system?
I think he's to blame as well.
Because he's making like-for-like substitutions.
I agree. And if you want to ask me about Liverpool, I feel Liverpool are just to blame. Because United, for United's defence, they're the away team. It's down to Liverpool as the home team to break United down. Or whoever goes to Anfield or the big clubs, it's down to the home team to find a way to break teams down. So Klopp was just as bad because he went like for like. He never did anything. He didn't take a midfielder off and put another guy up front, knowing that United were defending the whole game.
Right.
So he was just as cautious. But I'm not looking at it from Liverpool's point of view because I'm not a Liverpool fan. I'm a United fan. I'm looking at it from my point of view that, for me, as an attacking force, United should have been, I wouldn't say a lot better, but they should have been better than what they was, especially second half.
Right, okay. And I'm hearing Arsenal fans saying, well, if Wenger went into that game with the same mentality as Mourinho, they wouldn't have got spanked 4-0. So it works both ways, doesn't it?
But you've got to find the balance. There's a balance with a game plan.
Well, we can go on
all
night.
Absolutely, of course we can.
At the end of the day, it's not a great result, but it's a good result. I'd be much worried if it was a home fixture and that was the game we was watching. I'd be screaming more. You need to be doing more, Mourinho. The players need to be doing more. But away from home at Anfield, he's obviously had a game plan going into it. Stay tight, first 20 minutes, shut the crowd down like we always do. And then second half, if it's still 0-0, it's tight and Klopp changes it, then we can try and teak. And then that was the game plan. He didn't do that, Klopp. So he'd accepted the point.
That's right. Well, I'll go back to what Pascal Jimbonda said on the Facebook group page. He said, it's lost its spark, as in the rivalry. It's lost its spark a while back in terms of being the definitive match for the title. United's regular title rivals under Fergie were Arsenal, Chelsea and City. However, still the biggest derby, just like Inter, AC's still the biggest derby in Italy, despite both of them dropping off. I think it's a very, very fair analysis from Pascal there. I was going to ask you two about your take on the game, but let's talk about Mkhitaryan, because again, he went missing. Are you starting to see where I'm coming from now in terms of this? In terms of saying that he's an absolute dead weight,
I don't think it was a dead weight. I think it was his worst game in the United shirt by far. We might as well play with 10 men. But I'm not going to blame the attacking players as much because of how United was set up.
Okay.
Yes, they should have done better.
Right. Forget about that because we've discussed that.
Yep.
Mkhitaryan. Tell me about him. You still rate him up there? You still put him up there?
I think he's a really good player. I think he needs to do more. I do agree he needs to step up a notch because in the big games, he hasn't done it for me. But Mkhitaryan can play any position. He can play as a number 10. He can play wide left, wide right. He's versatile. When he's good, he's good. But we haven't seen a consistent Mkhitaryan often, in my opinion.
Rod?
I like him. I like Mkhitaryan. Look at his stats. Look at the goals we've scored. Look at the games we've won. We've drew one game. Just relax. He'll come. He's a good player.
No, it doesn't
for me anyway.
He's dog shit. But anyway, Mark, you've been pretty quiet there. Rodri mentioned the international break earlier. Do you think we would have seen a much more entertaining game had it not been for the international break, mate?
Yeah, I think so. From my, you know, personal thing of working in professional teams before, I think when you get an international break and your players go off to all different places with different coaching styles, etc., it takes a couple of days when they get back just to get them back into, you know, trying to work your way and things like that. So it's not the best preparation for everybody, and especially for two teams like Liverpool and United who have a lot of their players out in different countries. You know, to get them all back just a couple of days before and then get them ready for a big game like it is, a derby game, can be difficult. But you think with the players that both teams have, you could have seen a little more extra quality.
That's right.
Can I add something if I may?
Go on.
Do you know what it's lost as well?
Go on.
Your Carragers, your Gerrards, your Scholes, your Nevilles.
Yep.
That passion, that hatred, that desire, you know, in the dressing room, you are not losing to these lot. Make sure you know, all that.
Mm.
I don't think we've got the caliber players now that go in there. It's all selfies and whatever else, isn't are. It? You know, so I think that plays a lot now as well.
I agree. Right. Stoke City, they put up a fight for about 10 minutes, scoring twice to reduce Man City's lead from 3-0 to 3-2. But by the 80th minute, City had scored four more. Seven. Open brackets, SEVEN, close brackets for the Vidi printer lovers, too. Meanwhile, down south, Arsenal and Chelsea suffered shock defeats at the hands of Watford and Crystal Palace, respectively. Although, after hearing Troy Deeney's comments about how he and his teammates like to rough up Wenger's men, it shouldn't be much of a surprise. So, the David versus Goliath award of the week goes to Roy Hodgson and his band of merry men, who not only scored their first and second goals of the season, they also beat the reigning champions. Now, Mark, with the greatest respect to Palace, it's no surprise they had an extra spring in their step following the return of Wilf Zaha. They really need to wrap him up in cotton wool and even bubble wrap, don't they?
Yeah, I think so, Stal. He's a very good player, and I think he's proven it, obviously, when he come back into the team on Saturday. A real big talent in a team that's not, you know, no disrespect, but not a big team in the league with much talent in their team. So to have someone like that, you know, you've got to make sure he prepares right, he rests when he needs to rest, to look after him both on and off the field, and then hopefully they'll see the best out of him. And as he showed on Saturday, he can go and win games for them.
That's right. And Rod, what do you think the result will do for Palace this season? Is this a start of better things at Selhurst Park?
Well, you'd like to think so. Well, the Crystal Palace fans would like to think so. You know, they've got over the tough schedule of games that they've just played, which were difficult for anyone. They're playing the top four and the top five. So they've got through that. And then the last game, they beat Chelsea. And you can see the way he wants them to set up. You know, it's very simple. It's very, I'd say, English or British. 4-4-2, very rigid. And they've got a result by it. So, you know, some of the players would have known that way. And so they've adapted to it very quickly. But, well, not very quickly. You know, quicker than I say, De Boer did, but you know, De Boer wanted to do something intricate and go a different way, which is more difficult, and players sometimes don't grasp that way. And the way they played on Sunday or Saturday, was it? You know, it's easy for them.
That's right.
So yeah, it was a great result, and they should kick on now. Looking at the fixtures, winnable games. So yeah, it's looking up for them anyway.
That's right. And you, with Morata out injured, the onus was on Batshuayi to produce the goods, and surprise, surprise, you're for nothing. Nada, zilch. Hazard was ineffective, as was Willian. So why do I get the feeling Conte is about to find out what Mourinho went through with a lot of the players?
I don't think you'll find anything new about the players. I just think it's the second season, they're the champions. Second season is always more difficult because the teams up the game against the champions. Also, teams now will start knowing how Chelsea play their football as well, with the three at the back. So, teams are prepared better now to play against Chelsea. Something, again, not right at Chelsea this season. I don't know if it's the manager. I don't know if it's maybe, you know, insecurity of him being there for the whole season, or if he's leaving at the end of the season, if players don't know what's happening, if it's something behind the scenes. Costa and Terry as well are two massive characters in the dressing room that will be lost. No matter what you might think, the big personalities.
They're leaders.
They're leaders, especially John Terry, mm-hmm. you know, who loves the club as well. Going back to what we were talking about Liverpool, your Carragher's. Terry's another one, of course, at Chelsea. And maybe not having him has made an effect in the dressing room. And like you said, not enough leaders in that dressing room at the moment.
Yeah. I just think that they're too reliant on Morata to get goals at the moment. He's a fantastic footballer and he obviously has hit the ground running. But the fact that Diego Costa isn't there, I think it's really going to affect them. And again, I keep reiterating this. I keep repeating myself. Rudiger, Christensen, Azpilicueta, Luiz, Cahill. For me, it doesn't tell me that they can retain the title. Mm. That for those five defenders, even if they rotate them. For me, I don't think they're good enough. Zappa Costa, still, he's coming. He's done pretty well, to be fair. But again, Moses came back from international duty. He looked laboured. I don't know. I really don't know. But
the keeper's not the same, is he?
No, Courtois. He's that.
I think his mind's
one season on, one season drift. Possibly. But Navas has been playing pretty well for him. Mm. But anyway, let's move on to Troy Deeney and Rodri and Mark. Mark, you know Troy kind of well. What do you make of his comments about Arsenal?
Knowing Troy from back, you know, back in our early days, he will always he was not afraid to talk. But I think, you know, he's only saying what everybody's on their lips, isn't he? You know, we all think about it with Arsenal that they let people down and they don't always show their potential. And I think, you know, whichever way Troy said it on the TV, I think he was just saying what everybody else is thinking. So, you know, I think he's right in what he says. Maybe sometimes you have to be careful on how you say it, especially being in the position he's in. But as I say, knowing the guy, I think he's innocent with it, but he's also telling a lot of truth.
Mm. And Rod, it just seems that Troy Deeney was echoing everything you've ever said about Arsenal.
Yeah, exactly right. You know, you could imagine 10 years ago, Troy Deeney saying that. You can see Martin Keown seething when he sees it, can't you? When you watch him or lead any of the Arsenal ex-players, it just wouldn't have happened. They just took a soft belly. And for him to say that, if he goes to Arsenal, comes out unscathed, then it just doesn't lie what I say about him. Because even just professional pride, with anyone saying that to you, you want to react a reaction. So I'd expect a reaction from the Arsenal players when Watford go to the Emirates.
Well, you kind of expect a reaction from Arsenal immediately, aren't you? I mean, they've got Partizan Belgrade. Is it Red Star or Partizan?
Partizan
Belgrade. They've got Partizan Belgrade on Thursday in Belgrade. It isn't going to be pretty, is it? And regardless of exactly, regardless of what lineup Wenger puts out, these players are going to need to show, as Troy Deeney said, cojones. They really have to show. But I think, do you know what? To be fair, I think it's a breath of fresh air him coming out saying that, because he's basically saying what everyone else thinks. Basically, he said, you know, I'll look at one player, I'll give him a kick and see how they react. And Mertesacker, of all people, we're talking about a big giant here. I don't know. What do you make of
it?
Go on, Rodri.
No.
Go on, Rod.
No, carry on, yeah. Go on.
What do I think? I think he's brave. I think, like you said, I quite like it. In fact, it's coming out on national telly after the game and just saying it how it is. I thought it was brilliant.
I'm surprised the FA haven't picked up on it, or the Premier League haven't, you know.
The FA are probably thinking about the same thing. They're thinking, yeah, we agree, Troy. Let's just move on.
Exactly. Mark, Tammy Abraham bagged the brace in Swansea's 2-0 win over Huddersfield. He's shown a lot of promise, mate, but do you think he'll become one of the few youngsters to get a chance to shine at Chelsea?
I don't think so, Stan. I think it's the same with them quite a lot with forwards. You know, we look back at Lukaku and Mikel Fasal and people like that. Now Loftus-Cheek and now obviously Abraham as well. They seem to come through the academy and look like decent strikers, but never really break into a multi-million pound club that is going out and spending, you know, lots of money and bringing foreign players in. So it hurts us a little bit. And not getting the youngsters in there, but I think that they do a great job of bringing these players in and grooming them, and then they go out and play in lesser teams or lower leagues and become great strikers.
Mm. Solanke was another one, wasn't he?
Yeah.
And he was good in the reserve team at Chelsea.
That's right. So about Huddersfield then, without a win in seven games in all competitions, I know they sit ninth in the table, but they're only 4 points away from the relegation zone. Do you think their fans should be worried somewhat?
honeymoon period's over, isn't it? Mm. At Huddersfield. We knew at some point that this was going to come. It lasted a little bit longer than what we thought. Mm. I think they should be worried, but if they finish 17th, they're laughing at this. So that's their aim, you know? So, listen, I personally didn't think Huddersfield would start the season like they did. So credit to them for what they've done at the moment. And like I said, the honeymoon period's over. Teams are starting to, you know, notify what they're all about. And quality in the Premiership is a lot better than Huddersfield. Mm. So not surprised by the recent run.
Fair enough. And Rod, Bournemouth's loss at Wembley against Spurs keeps them in the bottom three. Now, it just seems to me they really need the folks to start showing the same kind of form he showed at Sunderland if they are to stay up.
Yeah, they do. They've all the hoo-ha about Eddie Howe, and they seem to be struggling. So, you know, it's not going for a minute. But yeah, they definitely need Jermaine Defoe to start scoring. Obviously, they did well last year without him. So they need other players to step up as well. But yeah, they're in trouble at the minute. But I'm sure they'll get out of it, Bournemouth. I'm sure that they'll have enough in the end. And, you know, Eddie Howe, you know, he's a good coach, so I'm sure they'll get out of it in the end. But yeah, Jermaine Defoe needs to start sticking his chances away, putting away last year.
Yep. And while we're on the subject of getting out of it, Mike Ashley has decided to put Newcastle up for sale, and he's hoping to conclude a deal by Christmas. Gents, I think something tells me there's actually more to this than meets the eye. I know Newcastle haven't been in the Premier League for a season to take advantage of the prize money, so is there a possibility that Ashley's actually found someone who's willing to pay above the club's valuation? What do you reckon, Mark?
Yeah, maybe. It's been an on-off saga with him for a few years now. You know, the fans love him and hate him. And so it's always been a difficult one. But yeah, I think he's very much a businessman, and he's definitely looking for a big check. So I think somebody, maybe a Chinese owner or something like that, has come and offered the money, and he's going to jump at the chance while he can.
You?
I'm surprised.
Yeah?
To be honest, yeah. Surprised in a sense that he had an interview, was it, at Sky Sports about a month ago, and it, you know, they were talking about the finances at Newcastle, and it was like, well, we know that we can't compete, and Benitez understands this, and I hope the fans understand that where we are. I think you're probably right. I think there is somebody there with big money, and he's decided, you know what, maybe it's the time to sell.
Yeah. Rod, what's your take?
Yeah, totally agree with Jan. You know, someone's obviously, he's a businessman at the end of the day, so obviously someone's coming and he's saying he's putting it up for sale, but there must be talks behind the scenes. And I hope they do get someone who's decent, who's got to own a good lot up there. You know, they needed a bit of luck because they've had a bit of nasty few years. So, yeah, good luck to them.
That's right. And the bit of news that broke earlier on today, Mark, Craig Shakespeare's been sacked as Leicester City manager. I think it's actually about a month earlier than I predicted. I thought it was going to be sacked end of November. Right decision?
It's a difficult one, isn't it, Stan? I think they're jumping at sacking managers now. And, you know, for me, you know, going way back, I don't think Ranieri should have been sacked after winning the league, but he was. And Shakespeare came in and done a great job as caretaker manager. But then, you know, they trust him to have the job and not really give him enough time to get in there and do the job on a full-time basis. But, you know, obviously the chairman's got his thoughts, and we'll have to see who comes through the door now to try and give them a push, because the last two seasons they've really struggled.
Yeah, the thing is, this always happens, and I knew that he was going to get sacked eventually, because you get a manager, he does reasonably well, then he gets sacked, they bring in another guy who everyone loves in and around the club as a caretaker manager, they give him half a season, and then they give him another half a season, and if he's not doing well, then he's gone. And that was effectively what's happened to Shakespeare. I think Michael Appleton is going to be a caretaker manager. Rod, do you know anything about Appleton? I know they did well, pretty well at Oxford City.
Yeah, well, he was manager at Oxford City. I know Appy. I've met Appy a few times. He's a Salford lad, so, but yeah, he was doing well at Oxford, and you know what's going to happen to him now. So hopefully he may get a chance, but I very much doubt it. I'm sure, you know, Leicester are going on like Real Madrid, sacking players here, left, right, and centre. It's Leicester City. You know, I just don't agree with it at all. You know, you didn't agree with him sacking Ranieri. I wish they got relegated after he did it, but they didn't, unfortunately. But you know, it's unfortunate you need to give these coaches a bit more time. You know, he did really well when he took over. Yeah, he's having a great patch, but ultimately it's a result business. And when you're drawing and not picking up results with the teams that you think you're better than or in and around at West Brom, Stokes, all the other teams, and you're not getting results against them, you know, you get these owners that panic and want a so-called facing. So, yeah, it's just unlucky.
That's right. Well, I think Appleton will shake things up. I mean, all he's got to do is show his biceps, man. He's huge. He can bench press a car, can't he? Massive. Jesus. Right, in other news, Jupp Heynckes got off to the perfect start in his second stint as Bayern Munich head coach, beating Freiburg 5-0. The result puts Bayern 2 points behind Dortmund, after Peter Boss's men suffered a 3-2 home defeat against Leipzig. See how I kind of salvaged that Dortmund thing? Yeah. The drama continued in Europe with two big results in Italy. Leaders Juventus stumbled at home, losing 2-1 to an informed Lazio, spearheaded by a rejuvenated Ciro Immobile. The defeat ends Juve's 41-game unbeaten run at home. However, game of the weekend undoubtedly was the Milan derby, where Mauro Icardi's hat-trick gave Inter a 3-2 win in a thrilling battle. Now, this has to be a contender for game of the season.
This was a proper derby.
Here we go.
Yeah.
Here we go.
If you want to compare Liverpool United to AC Milan, Inter Milan, but this had everything. Yeah. Attacking flair, controversy, had them all. It was a fantastic game of football. You know, even reading everybody's kind of Twitter reports and everything talking about the game, everyone was excited. Everyone enjoyed it. It was good to see both Milan clubs near enough at the same level. You know, Milan have spent a lot of money to try and get back to where they was. Inter Milan now with Spalletti has done a fantastic job. It was a proper derby. It was a really good game. I'm excited talking about it. That's how good it was. And Icardi, the man everybody loves to hate, Inter Milan. But they love him, really, the Inter Milan fans. You know, deep down, they absolutely adore him. What a hat-trick. Yeah. All right, the third was a penalty. But he's finishing.
The composure for that hat-trick.
For that. Yeah, just, you know, 90th minute to just kind of wait for the keeper. He just slides it. But his second goal, the volley. What a thing that was. Even the first as well. Great cross from Candreva. Oh, yeah. And then on the half volley, he just, you know, slides it in. It was a fantastic, fantastic goal. I'm surprised he stayed at Inter, Icardi. I think he can do a lot better.
Yeah. Well, funny you say it, because, Rod, ironically, it's almost a year to the day we actually reviewed Liverpool's goal of straw against United. And that episode, Mauro Icardi made our headlines for all the wrong reasons. So if you remember, he pulled out with the Inter. Yeah. Actually threatened criminals from Argentina to fight them. Now, as you know, a lot has happened since October the 19th, 2016. And Icardi has won the fans over, as Jan said, with his performance and his three goals against their deadly rivals. It's actually earned him a place in the history books. It's an incredible turnaround, isn't it?
It is. You know, you've seen it before. If you can perform on the pitch and you give everything for the shirt and everything for the fans, you know, they'll quickly turn around. And if you score in hat-tricks in derbies, they'll love you forever. You can say whatever you want. So it's a turnaround. We've seen it again in football. You know, next year we could be talking, you know, he's out the door, he said something or he's done something. It's that quickly. But yeah, it's a great result for him. And that trick on the derby, you can't get much better than that, can you?
I'll tell you what, Stone, if you want to talk about cojones, Icardi's got something. He's there, isn't he? Yeah. He has.
But he's a nut.
That's what I mean. He's a proper Argentinian streetwise. I quite like that about that.
We've seen these characters before, and the fans take to him. You know, 100 mile an hour, all show, all impact, and you know, the fans love that. And you know, you can say,
Icardi's the kind of person that would fight his dad for the last bit of bread on the table.
yeah, that's why they probably love him, because he's crazy.
There you go. Right, so Kaká, he's out the door. He said an emotional farewell to Orlando City fans on Sunday as he played his final game for the club. Now, unfortunately, it's been a disappointing three seasons for Kaká in MLS. Orlando didn't make the playoffs during his time there. Many feel he was a $7 million flop. Now, Mark, you're in the States. No doubt Kaká was a fantastic marketing tool for a new franchise, but what else do you think he brought to the table?
Not much, Dal, I don't think. You know, I watched him a couple of times play over at FC Dallas, and he didn't bring much at all to the team or to the field that night. The nights I seen him, but I think that, like you say, it's a massive marketing tool for these teams. But you know, we look at when Gerrard came over here and Lampard and a few of the other big names, and none of them really took it by storm, apart from the shirt sales and the media coverage that they got over here, and obviously bits and things for their families to do over in the States as well. Apart from that, everybody looks like they're at the end of their career and just going through the motions for the last year or two. And Kaká's a big one that has been disappointing throughout.
That's right. So it's Kaká by name, Kaká by nature, I guess.
Yeah, that's it.
Right. A player that is trying to emulate Kaká in terms of a success story, kind of something. I don't know how to segue this one. Ravel Morrison scored his first goal for Mexican side Atlas during the international break. Now, Morrison, who's on loan from Lazio, is trying to resurrect his career in Central America. Now, Mark, I'm sure you know about Morrison as he spent some time at Birmingham City. Do you actually think it's wise for a player with such a questionable temperament to be part of the world that has a violent drug trade?
I think it's a difficult one because he's a great player, you know, on the field. We had him on loan actually at the start of the season this year, and we thought that Harry Redknapp would be able to put his arm around him and make him, you know, sign him up and make him a player again for this year. But it was difficult. We didn't manage to sign him due to money and the financial issues. But yeah, it's going to be a really hard one for him because I don't think he can control himself off the field, which is a real shame because he can be a massive talent on it. And you know, we've seen in the past Manchester United getting rid of him because of his troubles. Birmingham had him, and again he left because of training ground fallouts and things like that. So, you know, the big open world of Mexico could be a hard one for him. But I think it's just going to take a coach to really, like I say, really put their arm around him and calm him down and try and get the best out of him on the field.
That's right. And Rod, at 24, Ravel still has time on his hands. So can he turn it around and be the player we all thought he'd end up being?
Yeah, of course he can. The amount of talent he's got, but touch on Matt. What Matt said, he needs to grow up a little bit. You know, it might be the best thing for him to go a million miles away from home because he obviously has trouble when he comes nearer to home. Because you know, I can remember when he was playing at West Ham, even when he was playing at Birmingham, he'd still come back on a Monday night and play with his mates at Fallowfield under the floodlights on the AstroTurf on a Monday night for 2 hours. So he likes being around his friends who are not the best of influences. So it might be a good thing for him to go away there, get a couple of seasons playing football and grow up a little bit and then come back and then who knows? Because he's a talent. He's definitely a talent. But he is, go back to Icardi, you know, he's obviously got a screw loose, but it's around the people, the bad people he was around, the bad influences. When he's other places, like away from home, he doesn't seem to get into trouble.
Yeah, I doubt his friends have actually travelled to Mexico, unless they're in Cancun, but...
Exactly. I know my side's bad, but it's not that bad.
It's about that, eh? Right, let's talk a bit about the Champions League games that occurred tonight. Liverpool thrashed Maribor 7-0. Even Oxlade-Chamberlain won the score sheet, believe it or not. Man City beat Napoli 2-1, although the Napolitano missed a penalty in the first half with Dries Mertens. And Spurs got a respectable draw at Real Madrid. What did you make of the English teams in Europe?
Good results for all of them, right? Yeah, to be fair. Tottenham was an impressive result away to Real Madrid, and Tottenham even had great chances in the second half to even win it as well. Navas pulled off a couple of really, really good saves. Liverpool expected, not the result, which is a great result, 7-0 away from home. Doesn't matter who you play, scoring 7 is always good for your confidence. And City, I expected City to win, and City are carrying on their good form at the moment. They seem to be kind of beating everybody they're playing at the moment. So, yeah, good results for the English clubs tonight.
There you go. And World Cup qualifiers, the playoffs were drawn today. Northern Ireland faced Switzerland, Croatia faced Greece, Denmark played the Republic of Ireland, and Sweden faced Italy. Mark, what do you make of these playoffs? Are they as straightforward as they seem?
I think so, and I think it's, you know, for Republic of Ireland, I think it's a great draw. I think if you would have asked any Irish fan when they first qualified for the playoffs who they'd want to play, I think Denmark would have been the team that they're all asking for. So I think over the two legs, that could be a quite a comfortable one for Ireland. And then, you know, the big one for me is Italy and Sweden, I think it is.
That's right.
Which will be, you know, two good teams going against each other. I do fancy the Italians, but you know, Sweden in their own ground can draw.
That's right. What do you make of the draw?
Croatia, Greece is a tasty one to me.
Yeah?
Yeah. Passionate fans home and away. So that's international football don't do it for me still. You know, I think we've discussed this before and this and that. It's not, again, what international football used to be and what it means to the players kind of representing their countries. Yeah, it's something I'm going to watch because it's interesting to see who gets to the World Cup. But Sweden, Italy and Croatia and Greece stand out for me out of them fixtures, yeah.
And Rod, what do you make of the draw? I know you probably don't care as well as so I but...
Yeah, correct. yeah, Northern Ireland's a difficult one, Switzerland, but, you know, it's not impossible. Obviously, like you touched on, Sweden, Italy would be a good game, and Republic of Ireland, if they'd asked for it, it probably would have been Denmark or Croatia, probably. So it's still difficult, but I agree with Jan, it's just a boring international. Okay. Boring games, yeah.
Fair enough. Well, I'm just going to say this.
And Wales are not in it, so I don't care.
I'm just going to disagree a little bit with Mark. I think Denmark could be the worst draw that Republic of Ireland could have got because of the fact that no one really understands or realises what they're capable of. I mean, Sweden, Italy, we know what they're capable of. Greece, you know, it's going to be defensive. Croatia going to be expansive. Northern Ireland is going to be some kind of a derby game, whereas Switzerland, you've got Xhaka and players like Shaqiri. I think Denmark will be a tricky one, especially with Eriksen in form at the moment. But yeah, let's see. It's over two legs and you never know. You never know.
Shaqiri?
Yep.
Shaqiri?
Yeah, Stoke. He's like, he plays for Switzerland.
Oh, yeah, the small one, yeah.
That's one. There you go. Right, let's try and end the show on a happy note. On a fun note, anyway. There's a newspaper or a sports publication called L'Equipe in France, and they reported an amateur game in France was abandoned after a woman staged a sit-down protest on the halfway line. Now, the unnamed local resident was incensed with the amount of balls that had landed in the garden, so she decided to make her feelings known. But it didn't end there. The police were called, and after paying the woman a visit, they found that she'd confiscated 186 balls with a combined value of 4,000 euros. Have you ever heard anything like this before in your life?
I haven't. No.
I'm sure.
When FC United got the, when they moved into the ground, they had a 3G pitch next to it, and to agree with the tenants, after 8 o'clock the floodlights would have to go off, and obviously behind it there's an old people's home, and they didn't put a net up, and the balls kept on going over and they kept on going over. And they wouldn't give them us back. They just wouldn't give them us back. They just had two shedfuls of black bin bags, and the general manager had to go over and literally negotiate the balls back and say, oh, "Okay, we'll try and help you out and get this for you or that for you." Just when we get the balls come over, because the balls were like they were like €100 a ball.
Yeah, yeah.
These jackal balls, and they were just keeping them.
I mean, to be fair, probably in Cyprus when I was a kid, just kicking the balls in people's gardens. I don't think I got them back either, to be fair. So.
In the end, we organised it. The only person that could go round was the general manager or myself, because the security guard liked me. He wouldn't give any of the lads went round. No, you're not getting it. They just shoot him off. It was a nightmare.
You sweet talked them, didn't it?
Pardon?
Sweet talked them. You got the gift of
the... Yeah, that's it, yeah.
That's the one. Mark, any... ball stories, as in the footballs.
I think, hey, I laugh because it's like reminding me of my old next door neighbour when me and my brother were kids. I think we probably lost about 4,000 balls as well over the 5 years we played in my mum and dad's back garden. But it used to be a knife that went through them, I think.
Do you know what? Funny you say that. There was an old bloke that lived on the corner of my mum's road. And it was myself and three others, one of them called Bradley. I'll never forget this. And Bradley was a little shit. And he used to play knockdown ginger at this old man's house. And the old man knew who it was, but because he's an old man, he never used to be able to catch him. So one day, Bradley decided to boot the ball in the guy's garden, just for no reason whatsoever, apart from being a little shit. Bradley knocked on the door to get the ball back. 10 minutes later, the old man comes out with a knife through the ball. Because you want your ball? Here's your ball. But he didn't take the knife out. So Bradley goes home, he gets his dad, and his dad comes marching. He goes, what are you doing, putting a knife through my son's ball and this and that? It was hilarious. thought the police were going to get involved. It's crazy. Almost like a street fight between an old man and Bradley's dad. But yeah, that's
the problem. That's the problem with some of these footballers today. You know, there's no street footballers anymore. No, you don't see kids playing the street anymore. It's not. It's probably because there's too many cars or ball games on the streets. I don't know, but I was always on the street playing football when I was a kid. It wasn't on the park. It was on the street.
And that's this old adage, isn't it? In the sense that you've got loads of South American ball players and Italians and Spaniards because they're able to play in the streets. They're able to play in places where they feel, well, I don't want to say safe, but comfortable. They don't have people on their back saying, oh, you can't kick the ball here, or no ball game signs. And I guess that's probably why this country is partly suffering a bit from a youth perspective, I guess.
Well, to be fair, though, we used to play with Coca-Cola cans or whatever you used to find to make football. That's what, growing up, that's what we used to play, you know. That was the fun of trying to play football in any way that you could. Like Rodri says, even now, driving or whatever else, you don't see anybody playing football anymore.
Mm.
You know, even at parks and things like that, nobody does it anymore.
That's right. Oh, well, I thought we were going to end the show on a happy note, but now we're talking about sullen things. Anyway, let's end it by giving our listeners our Twitter handles. You want to?
Yannickisj.
Yannickisj, short and sweet. Like you. Rod?
Thanks.
Rod James, because we can finish on that lovely pink hat you've got on today.
Yeah, man. Fresh, you got kids.
Yeah, it's salmon. Looking nice. Oh, is it salmon? Okay.
Brings out my eyebrows. My thick eyebrows.
We won't talk about eyebrows.
You've got still one, yeah?
Anyway.
You know, you still got the one.
Shall we carry on?
Meza.
So it's Meza 0102.
Tell us a bit more what you think at the moment.
Too much. So I three team this year, my 2003 boys team, they got invited to represent the club in the new ECNL league, which is the elite clubs national league, which is all over the state. So we play in that league as well as our local classic league and the National Premier League this season. So, you know, we've got a schedule of about 60 games over the year. Which can range from here in Texas to Florida, San Diego, Chicago, and things like that. So, you know, we keep them busy, and we're just trying to make sure that they prepare well and that they can get out and play at these high levels, as well as trying to get, their education done. And here in America, you find that they play every single sport that's out. So you'll have a boy that's out 7 days a week playing soccer, football, baseball, basketball. You know, you name it, they're out there. So it's very difficult to try and rein these kids in. But they're enjoying it, and I'm really enjoying working with them. So we just take it from there and see how it goes.
Great stuff. And on the final, are you happy with the appointment of Steve Cottrell and Lee Carsley?
Yeah, I think so. I speak to Cars quite a lot on a daily basis. So I was hoping he would get it, but I know he kept saying that he didn't want it. He wasn't ready to take that full job, and especially with his England stuff he does as well. You know, he wants to stay as a coach. And I think Steve Cottrell coming in is a good move. He was in there last year when we got kept up. He knows some of the players, you know. He's a good coach, good man management. So hopefully he'll come in. But as I say, and as I've said before, you know, the sacking of Rowett over 14 months ago has been the killer for us, because we've never had somebody now in the hot seat that can really stay. So I hope now Cottrell's one of them that can have 2 or 3 years under his belt or even more before they rashly sack him again and try and find somebody else.
It was a good start the other day, isn't it? Beating Cardiff 1-0.
Yeah, it was a great game, you know. I think I watched it on Sky, and I think they pressed when they needed to press, and they were well disciplined, which I think they're really going to get from him. He's got a big month ahead, you know, top of the league against Cardiff. They won. They got Millwall away Saturday. They play Villa in the derby the week after. So, you know, he can be an instant hero if you win those games, and you're three wins in three games and you won the derby. I think he's be carried out of the stadium.
There you go. See, we finally end the show with positive vibes about Birmingham City. Last time it was about Zola, and less said about that, the better, I think. Right, on a final note, for those of you listening on the download, please stay tuned as we have some bonus material for you right after this show. Now, 90s football expert Sid Lambert and I talk about Man United's 2-2 draw with Liverpool from the very first Premier League season. Remember that?
Robbie Fowler?
No. Matt Hughes, the ball.
Oh, the ones with the fans.
Stretford End.
And then
there you go.
Right.
See,
we were 2-0 down that day.
That's correct. Well done. See, there you go. Wonderful. You got something right. Well done. Right. That's
I was at that game. South Stand. Yeah.
Where were you, K Stand?
South Stand. Well, South. I was a Stret for them ticket holder, but obviously it wasn't there. So comps. Yeah. So I got some comps off.
It was like 33,000 that day. Crazy.
Mm. Yeah, it was a good atmosphere. Well, we went, obviously, yeah, like Jan said, we went 2-0 down, but Matt, your second goal was class.
You finished 2-2, did it?
First goal, sorry, it was class.
I
thought I had to get that
one. Whatever. You know, Clayton Blackmore's ball over the top, Hughes lobbed it over Grovelar, beautiful.
And then Gibbs crossed to Hughes last minute.
There you go, see? And Hughes celebrated like a G. Right, that's it from us this week. Follow us on Twitter at Shoot the Defence. We have a Facebook group page. Just join it and get involved. Until next time, take care of yourself and each other, as Sherry Spring would say. Hello, welcome to Shoot the Defence. This is our very first 90s nostalgia segment called Blast from the Past, and I'm joined by none other than Sid Lambert. What a perfect gentleman to start this segment. Sid, welcome back to Shoot the Defence. How you doing?
I'm doing very well, mate. West Ham got a point at Burnley, so in this day and age, that's a successful football weekend for us.
Absolutely. That's great to hear. But let's talk about this game that you've selected, and it's a game from... it's a big derby game, Manchester United versus Liverpool from season 92-93. First of all, why did you choose this game?
Well, we had that drab game yesterday, didn't we? Really awful game between Liverpool, Manchester United at Anfield. And then I looked at the calendar, and incredibly, nearly 25 years to the day, the reverse fixture took place at Old Trafford, and it was a cracking game in the first... the first meeting of the pair in the new Premier League, as it was back then, and it was full of incident, full of great players, full of, you know, some not so good players as well, and it was just a complete contrast from what we saw on Saturday. So I thought it might be worth looking through some of it.
Absolutely. And so what do you remember about the build-up to the game?
Well, first and foremost, the thing that struck me most when I looked at it and I saw the goals and the highlights, and you might remember this as well, still being a United fan, there was a crowd of 33,000 at Old Trafford. Do you remember why?
They were rebuilding the Stretford then.
They were indeed, and it made for a very eerie atmosphere at Old Trafford for a game that's normally quite, you know, charged, you know, fierce rivalry like that, and it was very strange to see the Stretford end just a pile of rubble.
Well, you know what's funny? I remember when Mark Hughes pulled one back, there was one guy in the Stretford end. I don't know whether he was security or doing something. He just kind of did this little skip. It wasn't even a celebration. He kind of like jumped. One of the most bizarre celebrations I've seen.
Yeah, and it was that season as well, if you remember, where Arsenal had the mural up at Highbury.
That's
so,
right.
You know, with the... with the sort of Premier League coming in, all the bells and whistles of Sky, it was just at that period in English football where clubs were starting to invest more in stadia, and we just went through this transition period where randomly one end of the ground would just be a building site.
Yeah, and I think Arsenal had didn't have crowd noises being pumped through the tannoy at the time as well.
Well, they could probably do with some of that today, to be honest, couldn't they?
I'll set you up nicely for that one, didn't
they? Let's get into the context behind this game, because it is really, really interesting to think about it. So it's Liverpool-Manchester United. Both teams have had a pretty ordinary start to the season. It was United had stumbled over the finish line the season before and gifted the title to Leeds.
That's right.
They were hovering around sort of sixth place. Do you remember... you probably remember about how you pretty much blew it the season before, and there was a bit of a hangover period at the start of this one, wasn't it?
Yeah, do you know what? I remember that season as clear as day, because it was the first season I was at secondary school, and I got a lot of stick from my classmates. And we lost the first game to Sheffield United, because Brian Deane scored the very first Premier League goal. In fact, he scored twice that day. One of them was a penalty. We should have had a penalty in the first half, but I'm not going to go into that one. And then the second game was Everton, and they battered us 3-0. And that sticks out most because I remember we were at sixes and sevens. I know Beards, all three goals from a counter-attack as well, just hoof forward. And the third one, Peter Schmeichel made a mistake, and Mo Johnson scored. And then
you know it's a bad night. You know it's a bad night when Mo Johnson's gone against you in the Premier League.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. But things kind of turned around. Then it was a Southampton away a couple games later, where Dion Dublin scored the winner. And that, I think, he broke his leg a week after against Palace as well, which probably contributed to United signing Cantona.
And by this stage, you were about 2 or 3 weeks away from signing Cantona, and it was a really... If I read out this team, I'd be fascinated to hear your recollection of the kind of where you were as a unit. So, in goal, you had Peter Schmeichel.
Yeah.
Back four was Paul Parker, Steve Bruce, Gary Pallister, Dennis Irwin.
Standard.
Midfield... This is where it gets a little bit interesting. Andrei Kanchelskis, Darren Ferguson, Paul Ince, Ryan Giggs,
mm-hmm.
and up front was Brian McClair and Mark Hughes.
Yeah. Yeah, so really the only questionable selection would be Darren Ferguson.
Very much so, and it was a kind of sign of the times because, you remember, Brian Robson was injured.
That's right.
Mike Phelan... probably wasn't the influence that Alex Ferguson expected him to be at that time of his career. And Neil Webb was still around. And he even came on a sub, I think, against Sheffield United in the first game.
Yeah.
And by then, you know, Neil Webb was about, well, he was about as popular in Manchester as a dog shit on the floor of the Rovers' return, really, wasn't he?
Yeah, that's right.
His days were numbered. Yeah, so that's Darren Ferguson's selection. I hadn't realised he was pretty much an ever-present up until this game.
That's right. That's right, because he actually took the free kick that led to Dion Dublin's goal, actually, in the winner against Southampton.
That's right. But you were, and there were interesting times up front as well, because Chucky McClair was starting to just sort of drift down the downside of his career. He'd lost a little bit of pace.
Yeah, that's why he moved to midfield.
He did, and that was when after Cantona arrived. And he had Mark Hughes, who was the classic... scorer of great goals, but not a great goal scorer.
Oh.
So up front, you were looking that little bit toothless, and in midfield, well, there were a couple of issues around that engine room, weren't there?
That's right. Yeah. Well, you know what? You mentioned Hughes. Hughesy carried us till Eric signed. He was scoring left, right, and centre for us. I think he got like 80% of our goals until Eric turned up.
Yeah, absolutely. He was the one that was sort of dragged. He got a late equaliser. I know he got a winner, I think, against Nottingham Forest, who were a dreadful team at that stage. You know, they were really spiralling out of control in Cluffy's last season. And he was doing what Mark Hughes did pretty much his whole career, which was to score important goals at important times. But no matter what was going on at United still, what was going on at Liverpool was really incredible. And there's a lot of similarities, actually, to sort of David Moyes at Manchester United.
Blimey. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, Graham Souness taken over at Liverpool, and you never, ever, as we've learned in football, you never want to replace a legend. Kenny Dalglish had gone, and this is where the similarities are. He left a bit of an ageing squad that needed rejuvenating, but Souness, being Souness, that sort of aggressive alpha male, instead of taking his time and rebuilding gradually, he just made wholesale changes. I mean, listen to some of these players that he got rid of. Steve McMahon, Gary Gillespie, Peter Beardsley, Ray Houghton, Barry Bennison, Dean Saunders.
Yeah.
All of those players, possibly Gillespie aside, still had plenty of legs in them. And then some of the players he brought in, Torben Pietnik, Istvan Kosma, Michael Thomas, Paul Stewart, Mark Wright, Nigel Clough. Now, a couple of those were very unlucky. Paul Stewart... Michael Thomas, I mentioned that last time we spoke, didn't I? Those guys never really got going due to injury. Nigel Clough never really settled at Liverpool. Mark Wright was already, he was struggling with injury too. And even a young lad called Nicky Tanner had got injured. But when you look at players like Torben Pietnik and Istvan Kosma, they weren't up to Liverpool standards. So what was going, Liverpool came into this game, I think, 1 point above the bottom three. They had a mixture of old players past their best and young players who basically weren't good enough. They'd had terrible luck with injuries, a poor start to the season. And 2 weeks earlier is the game that everybody remembers as the Rosenthal game. They got beat 4-2 at Aston Villa.
Yep.
Rosenthal hit the bar at 0-0. And everyone forgot that he actually scored later in the game. So in this one, they came to Old Trafford out of form, out of luck, and Graham Souness was running out of time.
Yeah, because I think their form was abysmal. They lost to Forest on the opening day, and Forest actually went down that season, didn't they?
They did, yep.
And then I think they only won 3 of their next 10, which... Going into the game against United, the odds were stacked against them. But again, it was a derby game, so you kind of expected it to be a humdinger, didn't you?
Well, you did. But 2 weeks before that, sorry, just after that Villa game, they played at home to Wimbledon and they'd lost 3-2. And John Fashanu had scored and Robbie Earl had scored twice. Mm. So they really were in rotten form. And when you hear this lineup, I mean, this back four has got to be the most ramshackle back four Liverpool's ever put out. So it's Bruce Grobbelaar, who'd been recalled to the side because David James was finding life tough in his first few games at Liverpool.
Yep.
Now this back four, Mike Marsh, not even a right back, playing at right back, Steve Nicol, Torben Pienaar and David Burrows.
Yeah.
What's your reaction to that?
Well, you know what, back then I wasn't too familiar with these players, so being Liverpool, I was bricking it, to be fair. But looking at it now and looking at what happened to their careers, it's a laughable back line, isn't it? I mean, I don't mean to disrespect them, but David Burrows will always be remembered for that foul throw, won't he?
Well, actually, I have to be fair. I mean, David Burrows, when he came to West Ham, he made himself a crowd favourite. And then he went on to Coventry and he played under Ron Atkinson and had a very, very good career. But Steve Nicol was sort of one of those players who was in his twilight years, and as we know, Torben Pienaar sort of become the byword for disastrous foreign signing, doesn't he?
Yeah.
And then go into the midfield. A couple of interesting young players here. Don Hutchison and Jamie Redknapp, just making their early forays into the first team.
Mm-hmm.
And then Jan Mulby, who was at the stage of his life where he looked like he was 6 months pregnant. and then you had Steve McManaman, Ian Rush, and Roddy Rosenthal. So, before the game, Sky were just bigging it up, saying Manchester United really should turn over Liverpool. But that's not how the game started. You've seen the goals. What were your impressions of that first half?
Oh, blimey. Well, I actually remember watching this game with my dad and being, you know, 11 years old, dreading going to school the next day. Being 2 goals down wasn't great, to be fair. I remember the first goal was a big deflection. Don Hutchison walloped it from like 25-30 yards. It took a massive deflection, and if Steve Bruce hadn't got in the way, Peter Schmeichel would have saved that easy. He would have probably just picked it up. And the second goal was Ian Rush's, and I remember Ian Rush, they were saying that he'd never scored at Old Trafford. And that was the goal that actually put him in front of who was Liverpool's leading goal scorer at the time?
Roger Hunt.
Yeah. So he, that kind of
what a number! What a number of goals this was as well. So 287.
Wow, that's impressive.
Yeah, but in the lead up to that goal, what people forget is Ronnie Rosenthal gets an awful lot of criticism. Everyone remembers him for that goal, but that miss.
Yeah.
Story against Aston Villa, the one that made sort of Danny Baker tens of thousands along own goals and gas. But there is a brilliant piece of skill. He absolutely roasts Steve Bruce, I think he is, and then cuts it back, and Ian Rush scores the sort of goal that Ian Rush scored 287 times. So yeah, Liverpool were bossing it at the break. Now, do you remember the substitution that changed the game?
I do indeed. He took off Kanchelskis, and he brought on Clayton Blackmore, because Blackmore set up the goal that pulled it back to 2-1, didn't he? He kind of like chipped it over the top for Hughes.
It was, and that goal is one of those, and it's only when you look back at these seasons you remember how many brilliant goals we were lucky to see.
Yeah.
Because that volley from Mark Hughes, I've never seen one like it since. You know, to try and describe it, we'll share the link on Twitter, we'll share the highlights on Twitter later, so people who are listening can actually appreciate how good a goal it was. Hughes is on the turn, the ball has come over his right shoulder. Somehow, in a split second, he's noticed Bruce Grobbelaar doing what he had a sort of penchant for doing, which was wandering into no man's land. And he's played a sort of cushion lob volley over Grobbelaar on the turn, one bounce into the net. It was brilliant.
Yeah. Yeah, but you know, that goal stemmed from David Burrows not clearing his lines properly, because I remember the ball fell to him and he kind of skewed it, didn't he? And it just went completely the wrong way.
And that pretty much summed up Liverpool's defending for that entire season, really. They had a different back four every week, and they were prone to some terrible errors. But I think even when Blackmore got the ball, Burrows probably didn't think there was much danger, but what a brilliant goal it was. And possibly only bettered by, or certainly equally as good, was the diving header for the second.
Yeah, yeah, that was an absolute... Do you know what? It was, again, from a long ball. I remember Paul Parker like lobbing it forward, and then Hughes flicked it on for Giggs, and he just took one touch to Hughes, and he came diving in. And again, that's just typical Mark Hughes, always putting his head in the right place.
Yeah, he was a scorer of great goals, wasn't he? And this was the 90th minute, big local derby, United under pressure, ropey start to the season, and there he is to secure a point. And while we're on Paul Parker, I tell you what, Paul Parker was very good at that long diagonal ball from right back, wasn't he?
Yeah, yeah. Well, he used to be a sweeper at QPR, and I think that was what he was used to doing mostly, just playing diagonal balls.
Yeah, and it worked, and it was a lot easier at Manchester United, where if he pinged it from right to left, he had a certain young lad named Ryan Giggs,
yep,
who he could aim for, and it was Giggs' cross that gave Hughes the chance to bury that header. United, 2-2 draw, they were 6th, Liverpool were 15th, both sides still with problems, but as you know, Manchester United were about to solve their striking problem in pretty spectacular style, so I thought it was worth revisiting. Really cracking game. We'll share the highlights on Twitter, I'm sure. And maybe I'll pop back next week and we'll do another kind of blast from the past.
Yeah, that'd be great, mate. That'd be great. It'd be great to have you back on to talk about something. I really enjoyed it. I was just thinking about it and looking back at the fixtures. And one thing I did notice, United actually played Everton twice before the Liverpool game.
It was a quirk of the fixture list. Yeah. They did a return fixture 4 weeks after. It's never been done again, as far as I know. But it was very odd at the time. So yeah, there were a few funny things that happened that year, and that was one of them.
Yeah, the only reason I could think of is maybe because of the Stretford end that they were rebuilding it, and it may have had something to do with, I don't know, fixture congestion or policing or something, safety. I don't know.
No, I can't remember the exact reason. I'll look into it, and if I find it, I'll let you know.
Yeah, that'd be great. That'd be great.
And can I just say, Stel, we've got three cracking 90s football's birthdays that happened today.
Oh, yeah?
So we're recording this on Sunday. Three cracking birthdays. A certain Andrew Cole.
All right. Yeah.
France's water carrier, as he was christened by Eric Cantona, Didier Deschamps. And one of the least celebrated forwards at Aston Villa, and there's a long list of those. Happy birthday to Bosco Balaban.
Oh, wow. That's a name. Blimey. I thought you were going to say Ian Olney for a second.
Well, Ian Olney. I mentioned him on a podcast a few months ago, and people didn't know who he was. Oh. And do you know, it took a tweet to me from Tony Daly just to remind the world, the immortal Tony Daly, just to remind the world who Ian Olney was.
Wow.
But yeah, there we go. Bosco Balaban celebrates a birthday today. I'm sure there's many Villa fans who sent him a card.
Yeah, well, hopefully they did. Great stuff. Well, Sid, thank you ever so much for your time, mate. Really appreciate it. That was fun.
No problem, mate. We'll chat again next week.
Absolutely. Well, listen, give our listeners your Twitter handle and how they can find out more about this 90s football nostalgic thing that you're doing.
Yeah, my Twitter handle is Sid_Lambert. And if every week we're posting a blog, we call it Back Where It All Began, where I'm going week by week through the 92-93 season. You'll find all the links on there. We've done 7 or 8 already. And if they go to 90s, that's 90sfootball.com, there's loads more on there. And yeah, loads of nostalgia. We're churning it out every day.
Brilliant. Fantastic. Well, guys, that was Sid Lambert with Blast from the Past. Hope you enjoyed it. And we'll be back again sometime soon. Take care.